From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On the program today, we talk with someone who believes he knows how to end the auctioning off of family homes the government seizes for not paying property taxes in Detroit. The
best thing to do to eliminate tax foreclosure on owner-occupied homes is to eliminate the tax.
We'll talk to our political commentators about legislation that would eliminate Michigan's ballast water regulations.
Michigan was leading the charge to protect the Great Lakes from invasive species, and now we're in retreat.
We'll talk about a new book with the author who grew up in Detroit and became a war correspondent.
As long as you're not dying, war is oddly exhilarating, or at least I thought so when I was 17.
And then a chat with a musician who made his own double bass.
That organ can sound down there, which you really want.
All of that and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. On today's program, we'll talk to our political commentators about eliminating Michigan's ballast water regulations, which help keep invasive species out of the Great Lakes.
This has become a race to the bottom.
But first, Detroiters will vote for mayor on Tuesday. First-term incumbent Mike Duggan is expected to win re-election handily. That's despite his opponent having one of the best-known names in Detroit political history. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick reports.
Peggy Noble is president of the College Park Community Association in Northwest Detroit. It's not one of your fancier Detroit neighborhoods. Most of the homes are pretty modest, but it's not what most would call a bad neighborhood either.
I would have to say our neighborhood is still pretty stable, decent.
Noble was an ardent supporter of Mike Duggan during his first campaign for mayor. It was partly due to people like Noble that Duggan, a longtime political operative and former hospital CEO from the Detroit suburbs, managed to win grassroots support.
I had him out on different corners, introducing him to the neighborhood, folks that didn't know anything about him. And it's all history now.
It's not exactly history, though, because now Duggan is running for a second term. And today, Noble thinks he's doing a wonderful job. She says he needs more time to really bring things back, but
we have lights now. The streets are being cleaned, trash has been picked up, houses has been boarded up, demolished.
That was basically Duggan's pitch to voters during the election's one and only mayoral debate last month.
We've turned down 65,000 lights, knocked down 13,000 homes, bought 200 buses, cut police and fire response time in half, and put 20,000 Detroiters back to work.
Duggan points to greatly improved basic services during his term, which also coincides with Detroit emerging from the nation's largest ever municipal bankruptcy.
I know the job's not done, but if you'll give me one more term, I'll do everything I can to build one Detroit for all of us.
But Duggan's opponent isn't shy about calling him out on anything, especially that one Detroit statement. Coleman Young II is a 35-year-old state senator from Detroit. Born Joel Loving, he's the son of Coleman Alexander Young, Detroit's charismatic and controversial longtime former mayor. In his opening pitch to voters during the debate, Young II used this cliche to describe today's Detroit.
Detroit is a tale of two cities. It's the best of times for those who are privileged, and the worst of times for everybody else.
When Coleman Young Sr. became Detroit's first black mayor in 1973, it was still a majority white city. Now, Coleman Young II is fighting to unseat the city's first white mayor since then, in a city that's 80% African American. But Young's appeal doesn't just target black voters. Rather, it targets the many Detroiters feeling left out and left behind by the city's much-touted post-bankruptcy revival.
I'm running for mayor for the people who have their water shut off, for the people who lost their houses due to foreclosure.
Good afternoon, this is Welfare Rights.
I need help, ma'am. I need God to help me now.
Well, God is not here, I'm here.
Maureen Taylor heads the Detroit-based Michigan Welfare Rights Organization. She takes phone calls like this one all the time, from a desperate-sounding woman who said she and her brother are living with their water shut off.
And what she explained was that her water has been off a week, and that she lives in a house with her brother who is HIV positive.
The woman says they're surviving solely off his benefits, about $700 a month.
I asked her what was the total amount of her bill that was due. And she said her water bill is $2,700+.
Taylor works with that other Detroit Young talks about, the chronically poor, sick, daily struggle to survive Detroit. That's still around 40% of the city's population. And for them, Taylor says things are only getting worse. Since Duggan became mayor in 2014, more than 100,000 Detroit families have experienced water shutoffs or property tax foreclosure. And they haven't been able to get any kind of affordability-based plans to address those chronic issues from the Duggan administration. And Taylor thinks in the next 10 years or so, things will just grow starker. She sees portions of Detroit becoming a kind of luxury destination.
And those luxury liners will pull over, and rich people will get off, and we'll be selling whatever trinkets there are. But they will hire the locals to add atmosphere.
But those Detroiters aren't the ones most likely to show up at the polls next Tuesday. And the fault lines in today's Detroit are more complex than they were back in the 1970s. As a result, all the headwinds are strongly in Duggan's favor right now. I'm Sarah Swick, Michigan Radio News.
It seems every time you turn on the news these days, Amazon is expanding services again, besides getting every medium and large city in the nation vying for the new Amazon headquarters, too. We saw the big online commerce company recently buy brick-and-mortar Whole Foods. So what else is Amazon looking at? Well, an article in Automotive News asks the question, could the Amazon of auto retail be Amazon itself? Katie Burke wrote that story, and she joins us via Skype. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Lester. Thanks for having me.
So how much does Amazon know about the car business?
That's yet to be determined. Currently they sell aftermarket parts online, and they do have a car buying research site. They also sell cars in France and Italy via partnerships with Fiat and Seat, but they do not sell cars in the U.S. yet.
Yeah, I was going to ask you how that arrangement in Europe happens. I mean, who do they work with to make that go?
They work directly with the automakers. So in the U.S., we have a franchise dealership system where automakers can only sell their cars through a franchise dealership. The laws work a little bit differently in Europe, which allows automakers to sell directly through Amazon.
Yeah, given those strict contracts between manufacturers and dealers, and in most states, the manufacturer is not allowed to sell directly to consumers. What are the routes Amazon could go in order to sell cars here?
The attraction that dealerships pose to Amazon is twofold. They could pose as great distribution centers, given the space of lots that they have and their location close to neighborhoods and city centers. So as car buying moves online, space opens up in these dealerships, kind of making them an attractive distribution center for Amazon to get other goods to customers quickly.
So here's how I kind of thought it might work. Tesla wants into Michigan really badly, wants to sell cars here and can't because of our laws. So if Amazon worked out an arrangement with an existing dealership somewhere in the state and sold Teslas through this dealership, so would that qualify? I mean, would that work in most states, considering the restrictions?
That I'm not sure of. That's an interesting proposition I haven't heard before. Tesla itself isn't really interested in working with the dealership. They like to control the whole process from production to delivery to the customer. But theoretically, if it was all done through the franchise dealership, they might have to modify some of the existing laws and agreements, but it could potentially work.
Have you even asked Amazon whether it actually plans to get in the car business in the U.S.?
Yes, I did. They did not comment on that. but I did talk to a few experts, some analysts who follow Amazon and others who follow the automotive retail industry, and there did seem to be a possible opportunity there, but there also is a lot of red tape and obstacles that would prevent that kind of collaboration.
You talked about Amazon Vehicles. What all does Amazon Vehicles do now?
So that is a car shopping research site. So if you're in the market for a new car, you can go to Amazon Vehicles and they can help you compare cars, pick what features you're looking for, and show you the cars that best match that, and then direct you to the dealership or retail outlet where you could find that car at whatever price.
Do they get a fee for service from the dealership or something like that? How does that work? Or is this just enticing people to get used to the idea of shopping for cars on Amazon?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more of getting the consumer mindset to thinking of Amazon also as an automotive site. I mean, eBay has a similar service. They have eBay Motors, where you can also buy aftermarket car parts and also research new vehicles. So it's just this move to online for the car buying process rather than relying on the dealership for start to finish.
Your story concludes with a quote that includes the statement, "Amazon disrupts." What does that mean as far as Amazon possibly selling cars in Michigan and in the rest of the U.S.?
I mean, Amazon started from selling books online, and now it's one of the biggest companies in the world. And it's gotten there by making unconventional business decisions. So essentially, and what it means is that you can't really predict what its next move is going to be, because that's how it's gotten where it's been, is where it is now. I mean, buying Whole Foods was a pretty big surprise for most people watching the industry, but it makes a lot of sense. So it seems like their main goal at this point is to disrupt brick and mortar sales, but who knows what they could have their eye on next.
Yeah, as the last paragraph noted, disruption can cause further disruption, which makes everything up in the air, right? I mean, it's a whole new world.
Exactly. Expect the unexpected.
Katie Burke wrote the article, "Could the Amazon of Auto Retail Be Amazon Itself?" You can find it in Automotive News. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks, Lester.
I want to remind you that if you miss any part of today's show, you can find it on our podcast. Just go to michiganradio.org, click on podcast to find the link. Up next, we feature a Lansing area artisan, and then we'll hear from a former war correspondent turned diplomatic wife.
One minute I was Lois Lane, this kind of steely-eyed girl reporter with the overnight bag at the ready by her bedside, and the next minute I was Mamie Eisenhower cross-pollinated with Princess Grace.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. We travel the state to talk to people who make beautiful and useful things, and we call the series Artisans of Michigan. We're visiting with Ed Fidowa. He plays the bass in the Lansing Symphony Orchestra. He also plays in jazz ensembles, and he repairs bass instruments for players from all over. But that's not why we're at his house. We wanted to talk to him about the double bass he built.
I always wanted to make a bass, but it took me 25 years to get around to it.
Why?
Well, it's a big job. It's kind of daunting, but once you start it, it's pretty cool. Now I want to do another one, but I can't get started on that yet. It takes a lot of time. It really does.
What was the most challenging part about making this happen, besides getting started?
Let me think about that. Well, it's making the top, getting the arching in the top correct. I had the original 1806 Galliano here, and I could look at it, I could measure it, but I think I graduated that top three times before I was happy with it. Before I went, that's it. And I would show it to friends who made violins, and they'd say, you're a little high here, you're a little low there. And you can just run your hands over it, and you can feel, it's a little high spot.
His bass is a reproduction of an 1806 Galliano made in Naples. And this has been in the works for a while. He'd been given some already cured maple wood to make the instrument some 25 years before. Over time, he acquired some spruce and the other material he needed. He ordered a handmade machine head. That's the keys used to tune the strings. That came from London. Now, I don't know about you, but if I took on a project like that, I can't imagine what it would be like to get to play it for the first time.
Well, I was kind of excited. I couldn't wait to get the strings on it. I actually strung it up in the white. That means with no varnish. I just wanted to play it. And I liked it a lot. I had to do some changes. I took the top off after about a year. It was made in October of 2015. I finished it then. I took the top off a year later because I just wasn't quite happy. I wanted to take some more wood out of the inside of the top, which is called regraduation. So I did that, and then I was even more happy with it.
Can we hear it?
Sure. So pizzicato. It's got some ring. Again, this is my orchestra bass. So it's got some nice low end, but I don't use it for jazz. So that's the kind of pizzicato sound I can get. The nice puff. And then I put a bow on it. And what I like about the bass with the bow is it's got that organ kind of sound down there, which you really want in the orchestra. So it's, yeah. It's a good solo bass, too. You can get around it.
And he must have done a pretty good job because this past summer at the International Society of Bassists Biennial Makers Competition, Fidowa was awarded a certificate for tone. Looking at his bass, the one thing that is striking is it appears to be a really old instrument, not something he just finished a couple of years ago. He says he wanted his bass to look a lot like that 1806 Galliano.
Because the original has got a beautiful patina, and I wanted to capture some of that. So there's a lot of nicks in this thing. As I'm applying the varnish, every layer I'm putting new nicks in, new scratches, in the right places, so it doesn't look contrived. And so I just love that look. Any new bass.
What do you use to make the scratches?
Everything. I use bows, you know, here, bass bows. I use belt buckles for the sides. Just any old tool that will scratch. But each nick is a little different. Because otherwise it looks like, well, someone took the same tool and made all those marks. But I love the patina of an old bass. A cared for bass. I mean, if it's all nicked up and scratched without being touched up, that's not cool. But when you go over it, and you make it look like this, those scratches are deep, but they've been there a long time. That's what I wanted. So that's what that's about. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, I had somebody say, oh, that's a Galliano. I kind of let him on a little bit. I says, yeah. And then finally, about an hour later, I said, well, it's a copy of a Galliano. Because I had him snowed a little bit, you know, which was cool. I kind of played on it.
Fidowa says he's going to build that second bass, but he's not going to do it on commission. He wants to take the time that it takes. For now, he's satisfied playing the bass that he created, made with his own hands. Ed Fidowa, our latest Artisan of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. All right, confession. You know, sometimes words just fail you, and I could not come up with the traditional little summary of my next guest. So I'm just going to tell you the title of her book, Dirty Wars and Polished Silver, The Life and Times of a War Correspondent Turned Ambassadrix. Welcome, Linda Schuster.
Thank you very much.
It was a fascinating book. Let's start with your early life. You grew up in Detroit. How did that life, and I'm thinking mostly of your views of your mother's life, affect you?
When I was growing up in Detroit, I thought it was beyond boring. And back then, the motto on the Indiana license plates was wander, which I took as excellent advice for anyone raised in the region. It was sort of like grow up and leave. And rejecting my mom's life, which seemed beyond boring to me, was part requisite youthful rebellion and sort of part desire to see the world. And that desire was fueled in part by a stamp collection that I had as a kid, which piqued my interest in faraway places. So parents, be warned. Keep those stamp collections away from your children. They can lead to all sorts of subversive ideas.
Well, the first chance you got as a teenager, you went to Israel at a particularly interesting time in its history. But first, tell us, what were you doing there?
I decided, I had worked in a bakery in suburban Detroit every afternoon and weekends during high school, and figured out that if I could just get there, I could live there and work and study. And so I basically ran away from home at age 17 after finishing high school and landed about 5 minutes later in the middle of the 1973 Yom Kippur War.
Right.
Yeah, it should have scared the daylights out of me, but instead it just whetted my appetite for adventure.
Yeah, I mean, that came out of nowhere. You didn't see it. I mean, you were picking apples one day, and the next day there are shells dropping around and tanks on the horizon. Well, tell me what you were feeling at that time.
Excited. It was, as I write in the book, as long as you're not dying, war is oddly exhilarating, or at least I thought so when I was 17.
It kind of created a path for you, but at the same time, you didn't plan to be a journalist, so how'd you end up being a reporter, becoming a reporter?
After the war ended and I had spent some time in Israel, I decided I did want to live abroad and I wanted a life adventure, but I wasn't quite sure how to achieve that. So I came back to the States and I went to the University of Michigan for my BA and sort of at the last minute decided I needed some sort of craft. Otherwise I couldn't support myself. So I did a master's of journalism at Michigan and then got very, very lucky because the Wall Street Journal hired me directly out of school. And when I went to New York to interview with the editors, they said, which of our many domestic bureaus are you interested in working in? And I said, oh, I never want to work domestically. I only want to work abroad. And they nodded understandingly and promptly dispatched me to their Dallas bureau, which for a New Yorker probably is foreign.
You eventually did become a war correspondent, but you really have to earn that title. Tell me about your first experiences.
Well, I got very, very lucky. So about a year after I landed in Dallas, for some reason, the Dallas bureau back then of the Journal was responsible for Central America. And so within a year of getting to Dallas, I was named their Central America correspondent, which at that time, this was the early 80s. This was one of the hottest stories in the world. And this is when the Reagan administration was becoming increasingly more involved in the wars down there.
You quickly found yourself in El Salvador. What happened there?
Actually, I found myself in Costa Rica first, and that's actually where I met my first husband, Dial Torgerson of the Los Angeles Times, who was a veteran foreign correspondent, and I had the very good fortune to meet him on, I think, the third day of my very first reporting trip abroad.
And you eventually became involved, as you said, he became your husband, but it was not a simple relationship. You were both on assignment in different places, and when you got together, it was really special. But war correspondent is a dangerous profession. What became of Dial?
Yeah, trying to arrange, I mean, we worked for different papers, we had very different audiences, we wrote very different sorts of stories. So trying to arrange getting together was obviously very difficult. So we could sort of snatch little weekends together in the various capitals of the countries we were covering. And we managed to squeeze in a wedding ceremony in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, in between assignments. And then 10 months later, he was in a car with a photographer on the Honduran-Nicaraguan border, and their car went over the landmine, and they were both killed instantly.
Can you give us any idea of how you were feeling at that time? This was still new love to you.
Yeah. So, as someone put it, we were still in the keeping the bathroom door stage in our relationship. It was awful. And I was probably the last person on earth to find out about it. At that point, I had been named Mexico bureau chief for the Journal. And I was in Mexico City on assignment when that happened. And by the time I found out, which was about 1 o'clock in the morning, the whole world knew. And I found out by the AP bureau chief in Mexico City calling me and telling me.
You continued as a journalist, as a war correspondent, but you eventually found yourself in the world of diplomats. How did that happen?
After Dial died, I mean, I still truly believed that journalism was a very noble calling and a really important profession. But increasingly, it became more difficult to sort of justify the kind of danger that I faced constantly. I mean, you see among foreign correspondents, a lot of them turn into what I call action junkies. They just can't. They become so addicted to the adrenaline rush of covering war that they can't do anything else. And you see a lot of broken marriages. You see a lot of alcoholism. And I just really didn't want that. And by the time I was in South Africa covering sort of the final throes of apartheid, and I had been very fortunate to meet an American diplomat and to fall in love again. And at that time, I was targeted by assassins in South Africa. And I have to say that covert war is just as scary as the stuff with bombs and bullets. And so the diplomat asked me to marry him, and I decided that I could give up the reporter's notepads for the little pillbox hats and white gloves of diplomacy, but still live a life of adventure and write about it.
How was that transition from war correspondent to spouse of a diplomat?
It was difficult. It sort of felt like one minute I was Lois Lane, this kind of steely-eyed girl reporter with the overnight bag at the ready by her bedside. And the next minute I was Mamie Eisenhower cross-pollinated with Princess Grace. It felt like a bit of a throwback. The State Department requires all of its ambassadors and their spouses to take a 2-week course that I called Ambassatrix School at the State Department. And it really felt like a throwback to the 1950s, because while our husbands, and back then all of the ambassadorial appointees were men, got these juicy briefings on their respective countries, we women were treated to lectures on such scintillating topics as your China patterns and you.
As it turns out, being a diplomat and being an ambassador, as your husband became, doesn't fulfill the deal that you had struck, and that is some safety instead of being in war-torn areas. But that didn't actually play out as you thought it might.
No, it didn't. When we moved, so he was named, he was ambassador to Mozambique in Southern Africa and then was ambassador to Peru. And when we got to Peru, our house had been blown up 4 times by terrorists. And any time we traveled outside the house, even just to get ice cream, we went in a 3-car bulletproof convoy that packed a small arsenal. We had 10 armed bodyguards anywhere we went. And not long after we got there, my husband was at a reception and at the house of the Japanese ambassador and left the reception just 30 minutes before guerrillas, armed with submachine guns and rifles and tear gas and grenades, attacked the house and took hundreds of guests hostage. And actually, this is the true life event on which Ann Patchett, the novelist, based her book Bel Canto.
I want to go back to your mother, because your view of her and her life changed through the years. At what point did you decide what she had was worth having for yourself?
Well, I completely surprised myself by waking up one morning at age 38 and deciding that I wanted to have a child. I never wanted to have a child. It seemed to smack so much of her life and to be so conventional. And I gave birth to our daughter in Peru, and that changed absolutely everything. And I think having gone through all that I went through and then having a child, I really began to value the things that she had valued growing up. But for a slow learner like me, it just took a few well-aimed rockets to get me there.
In the epilogue, you mentioned an event involving your daughter that, in a way, was repeating history for you. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. It's sort of the sins of the mothers visited on the daughters. Our daughter decided she was going to go off with her youth group to Israel one summer. And, of course, I had to say yes. And about 5 minutes after she got there, the Gaza war started, and the people who were escorting them around the country were moving the kids sort of all over Israel like little chess pieces, trying to get them out of the way of the rockets. And in fact, she was in a town that was hit by a rocket. And I guess the difference between when I was in Israel during the Yom Kippur War and when she was there during the Gaza War is that you had things like instant messaging, and so I could experience her fear in real time.
How's life for you these days?
It's great.
I mean, you live in Pittsburgh now. You write a lot.
It's wonderful. Pittsburgh is a great city. We've lived here now, I think, for about 6 years. And as I obviously wrote this book, and I do a lot of freelancing, and I'm beginning to think of my next project, book writing project. But yeah, it's great not to be covering wars.
Linda Schuster is a former foreign correspondent for The Wall Street Journal and the Christian Science Monitor. And she later found her life immersed in the world of diplomats with her husband, who was ambassador in Mozambique and Peru. The book is called Dirty Wars and Polished Silver, The Life and Times of a War Correspondent Turned Ambassadrix. Thanks very much for talking with us.
It was my pleasure.
Linda Schuster will be at the Detroit Jewish Book Fair on Monday, November 6th at 2:30. That's at the Jewish Community Center of Metro Detroit. Coming up, we'll look at a radical proposal to address Detroit's foreclosure crisis. That's in 10 minutes, here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. More than 185 species of foreign fish, algae, plants, insects, and viruses have been brought into the Great Lakes, and many of them are invasive species damaging the Great Lakes. About a third of the invasive species in the lakes brought there in the ballast water of ocean-going ships. They picked up the ballast water in a foreign port and sucked up aquatic life with it. For decades, that ballast water and the things that lived in it were simply pumped into the Great Lakes ports as the ships adjusted to loading and unloading cargo. Think zebra mussels, quagga mussels, round gobies, phragmites, and other things that have damaged the lakes and wetlands. In 2005, Michigan passed a law requiring those ocean-going ships to obtain a state permit before docking in Michigan's ports. That permit certified the ships would either not discharge ballast water or that the ship would have ballast water treatment to kill off those foreign critters. Michigan felt the federal government was not doing enough to stop invasive species in the Great Lakes. It took a while, but there are now stricter federal regulations on ballast water, and some Michigan legislators want to get rid of that state law and just follow the U.S. Coast Guard's regulations. Joining me to discuss that are our Friday commentators, Vicki Barnett, a former mayor of Farmington Hills and a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema, a senior policy fellow with Public Sector Consultants and the former Republican majority leader in the state Senate. He joins us by Skype. So, Vicki, this sort of bill has been sponsored or co-sponsored by Representative Gary Glenn repeatedly. He argues that this Michigan ballast water restriction is blocking development of Bay City as a deep water port. How necessary is this Michigan law?
Well, the law passed out of the House yesterday, and it passed with a major amendment put on by Representative Andy Shore. And that amendment still holds to higher standards should the federal standards or the Coast Guard standards be diminished. The idea when we originally passed the law in 2005 was we were assuming, wrongly so apparently, that other Great Lakes states would jump on board and also require treatment facilities on board ships to treat ballast water. That didn't happen. In fact, all of the other states to which we are a party of the Great Lakes Compact have decided to do this, what they call harmonization with the EPA and with the Coast Guard standards. So Michigan is out there with higher standards, and yet the lower standards are still in effect for most of the other states and the two provinces that feed into the Great Lakes, which makes Michigan's law basically untenable, because even if they come in and follow the other laws, that ballast water is not going to have treatment on board ships. So there was a logical reason for Michigan to join the harmonized states.
Ken, international cargo ships make up a fraction of the cargo ship traffic on the lakes. It's been argued that the economic benefit of those particular ships falls far short of the economic damage that's been done by invasive species they brought to the Great Lakes. So how much sense does it make to drop the Michigan law to help Bay City develop a deep water port and just conform with the U.S. Coast Guard and EPA regulations?
Lester, I think this has become a race to the bottom. You know, Michigan actually, about 17 years ago, this debate began in earnest. As you mentioned, Michigan passed its stricter law in 2005, and at that time, Michigan was leading the charge to protect the Great Lakes from invasive species, and now we're in retreat. This has become, like I said, a race to the bottom where the floor becomes the ceiling, meaning that because you have so many jurisdictions, federal, Canadian, many states, whoever has the lowest standard kind of sets the ceiling. And that's what I see happening. And I think it's unfortunate because Michigan has more to lose than any other of the Great Lakes states. We have more Great Lakes shoreline. We're more dependent economically and recreationally than other states have. But where at one point we were leading the charge to deal with this issue, we're now in retreat.
So what's changed? I mean, this is just 12 years ago that we passed this law. Have attitudes about having stronger state environmental protections for the lakes shifted?
I think it's a regulation and a change in the mindset of those that are in governing positions and are in the majority in most of the states. And I don't really want to say that this is a Republican versus Democratic issue, because it's really not. We saw bipartisan support for this bill, and we saw Republicans and Democrats both voting against the bill yesterday. Unfortunately, it got enough votes to pass. Michigan was the leader. We were expecting the Coast Guard to require ballast water treatment facilities on ships back in 2008. That didn't happen, and it's been a slow retreat since then. And unfortunately, Michigan can't protect the Great Lakes alone. She needs her partners in the other Great Lakes states and the two Canadian provinces. So I agree with Ken. It is a very unfortunate issue. And had they all come aboard, no pun intended, we could have protected the Great Lakes with a much stronger law that would have been in effect for all of the Great Lake ports. What's happened, though, is that our agriculture growers have to ship their products much further because they can't load onto ships in Michigan. So it's hurting our agricultural development, and it's hurting the development of our port. And it's not just for the Bay City port. It's also for the Detroit port. And I want to point out that we've authorized the building of the Gordie Howe Bridge, International Bridge, which is essential in bringing in product from Europe through the real deep port in Halifax, and then bringing all of that material down into the gateway to the heartland of the United States, which is right through Michigan and its ports. I'm hoping that we have not given up on ballast water treatment inside of ships. The technology exists and it should be adopted, but this is where we are.
Hey, you two, before I let you go, the Michigan House turned down an auto insurance reform plan that was backed by Speaker Tom Leonard and Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan. Thoughts on that, Ken?
Well, it's deja vu all over again. I mean, 30 years ago when I got elected to the House and I was on the insurance committee, this was a hot issue back then. And in spite of every kind of run at it to change Michigan's no-fault law, where we have unlimited medical benefits, the only state in the country, it always crashes and burns on the ramifications, potentially, of making changes.
I tell you, guys are full of puns today. On board, crashes and burn. Vicki, what are your thoughts about this turning down the auto insurance reform
bill? I was glad to see it go down yesterday. We have probably the best case scenario for protecting families and people who are catastrophically injured in car crashes. And I am so grateful every time I write that check that should anything happen to me or my family, that we are protected. At one point when I was in the legislature, I tried to see how much it would cost if we had the PIP portion, the personal injury protection portion that is added to everybody's bill that everybody's talking about is blowing up insurance rates. It's about $165. So that's not the largest contributor to high insurance rates in Michigan. I wanted to see if we could have it paid for at the pump. In other words, raise the gas tax to cover the PIP portion of insurance. It would have been about 7 cents a gallon, and it would provide guaranteed coverage for everybody in the state of Michigan. And the beauty of it, had it been approved or encouraged, would have been those people who drive more and are putting themselves more at risk would be paying more through the pump for the insurance.
The problem I see with that, though, is PIP has expanded so much, you'd have to keep raising the gas tax to keep up with it. It seems like
Actually,
those medical
it really
costs.
Has hasn't. And that's the interesting thing. And if we had every person who drives insured, and that's the real problem with the insurance debate. We have so many uninsured drivers because they can't afford insurance. Then they would also be paying at the pump when they get gas, so they would be insured. And they would be driving down the overall cost for every individual.
Vicki Barnett is a former Democratic legislator, and Ken Sikkema is a former Republican legislator. Hey, thanks, and have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks, Lester.
Many people in Detroit cannot, or sometimes in the case of landlords, do not pay property taxes. Every year, the Wayne County Treasurer's Office seizes owner-occupied homes and puts them up for auction. Even with recent efforts to get homeowners on installed payment plans, lower interest rates, and letting more low-income people know that they might be eligible for a property tax waiver, it's not been enough to keep many people in their homes. There's a high rate of poverty in Detroit contributing to the problem. A recent article in the Free Press noted that a professor of law at Wayne State University has some ideas. John Moak has been researching Detroit for decades, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Lester, thank you very much.
You argue for abolishing the residential real property tax on owner-occupied homes. We'll get to how that might happen and how to replace that lost revenue, but let's start with why. Why abolish property taxes on owner-occupied homes?
Well, there are a couple of good reasons, but the most important is that the population of the city is largely poor. 40% of the city's in poverty, and a large percentage is just above the poverty level. The median family income is half the national median family income, roughly in the range of $25,000 a year for a family of four. And these families have difficulty making ends meet, feeding themselves, providing for some health care, covering their taxes and other repair problems with their homes. They can't afford on a regular annual basis to pay the property tax. And that results in a large number of foreclosures, thousands and thousands every year, and homeowners being thrown out. Some of them stay on after the eviction and basically are squatters in their own homes. And it's a very, very serious public issue, public welfare issue. And in my view, given the distressed conditions of the city and its neighborhoods, the most important thing to do is, the best thing to do to eliminate tax foreclosure on owner-occupied homes is to eliminate the tax. No tax, no foreclosure. People can stay there and do as they are able to do in maintaining their property and not becoming homeless. Now, there are other advantages also to eliminating the...
Let me stop you, because I want to ask you a couple of questions about the impact of that. If property taxes on owner-occupied homes were eliminated, how would that hit the city of Detroit's budget?
Well, the city of Detroit, unlike most local governments that historically have relied heavily upon the local property tax to support their costs, their delivery of municipal services, the way it's worked out over time in the city of Detroit is that the local property tax is a very small percentage of total city revenue. So revenue from the income tax, revenue from the casino tax, revenue received from state revenue sharing and other sources represent almost 90% of the revenue that the city receives to support their needs and to deliver city services. And that's very much different than other local governments nationwide and within the state that rely heavily upon the local property tax. But nonetheless, it does represent a smaller percentage of the revenue, and there would need to be a way in which to find a replacement because the city is financially strapped. So
right.
Even the loss of 10% or so.
You mentioned four different ways here. Some of them would require some changes in state law, but let's go through a few of them. You say, okay, owner-occupied homes, don't tax. Landlords, do tax. You say small tax on exempt properties such as nonprofits, such as hospitals and churches, that one probably is going to raise some eyebrows.
Well, let me say that in terms of the total property tax itself, it represents maybe 10 to 15% currently of the total city revenue. Owner-occupied residential property is only a small percentage of that percentage. So a large percentage is paid by industry, by commerce, by landlords, and by other taxable properties. So what we're talking about in terms of eliminating the revenue stream from owner-occupied property taxes is a small percentage of a small percentage. Now, in terms of finding a replacement, there are, I'm not suggesting that investor-owned properties be excluded, and there are some other avenues. I mean, local governments, if the legislature allows it to occur, have been allowed to impose other taxes and fees than the city now imposes. One is a sales tax. Now, that would require a constitutional amendment because sales taxes are limited in the Constitution. But law reform, you know, could include a constitutional amendment as well as state law reform. You know, in order to accomplish this objective, there'll have to be some serious thinking about the various approaches that need to be implemented, but all things are possible.
You note that in the mid-70s, the Detroit Downtown Development Authority and the Tax Increment Financing Authority have seen all of the increases in property taxes stay in downtown. A lot of powerful interest there. How do you get them to consider letting go some of that tax money so the neighborhoods can do better?
Downtown has a Tax Increment Financing Authority, and since the mid-1970s, all the increase in value in terms of rehabilitation of buildings, new buildings, increase in land values, which have been skyrocketing recently, all the increase in property tax revenue from those increases have been diverted to the Tax Increment Financing Authority Fund and kept downtown and reinvested in downtown. And, of course, the developers and the leadership downtown is not going to be particularly enthusiastic about sharing some of that revenue now or eliminating the Tax Increment Financing Authority altogether, which was done by Governor Brown in California a few years ago. But it will require leadership by the mayor if that's to occur. But the reason for the Tax Increment Financing Authority and diverting increased revenues downtown was to prime the pump, to allow the downtown decline to diminish, the downtown area to stabilize and be prepared for new development. That's now occurred. And the rationale for the Tax Increment Financing Authority that existed in 1975 no longer exists. Now, I understand developers aren't going to want to give up the golden goose, but there is no longer the same rationale for keeping increased downtown property revenues downtown.
Every time I read a story about foreclosures in a newspaper, inevitably there are lots of comments that go something like this. You know how I prevent foreclosure in my house? I pay my taxes. There's not a great deal of empathy among people in the suburbs or in outstate Michigan. So how likely is it that the Michigan legislature would change the law to allow Detroit to abolish real estate taxes on owner-occupied homes and the other changes you suggest?
Well, you know, it requires some convincing of the people in the suburbs and outstate that this is needed to preserve the quality of life or to improve the quality of life throughout Detroit's 140 square miles. But if legislation were crafted for distressed cities or in particular Detroit, that didn't affect other communities around the state, and that's not unusual. There are a number of laws that apply only to Detroit or only to particular types of cities. And you allow the city to opt into the legislation if the city council wants to do it, there's no real detriment to any of the other cities around the state. You know, there's another side to abolishing the real property tax on owner-occupied homes, and that is that there are many, many vacant homes standing in the city, okay? So what you want is people to come in to take those homes over and rehab them and help save the neighborhoods. If they do that and they don't have to pay a local property tax, that's a strong incentive to doing it. In addition, you have a lot of occupied homes around the city, and you want to encourage people to stay. You don't want to have any loss of more loss of the middle class or population in the city. If you abolish the real property tax, it's an incentive for people to stay. So there's three strings to the bow. One is to prevent people from being evicted. Another is to encourage people to come in and essentially take over vacant homes and rehab them. And the third is to convince people who are living in occupied homes who can pay their tax not to move to the suburbs but to stay.
John Moak is a law professor at Wayne State University and an urban affairs expert. He's arguing for abolishing residential real estate property taxes on owner-occupied homes in order to slow down this foreclosure crisis. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
That's our show for today. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening. Don't forget the time change this weekend. The clock falls back 1 hour, and our friends in the firehouse recommend changing the batteries in your smoke alarms. Have a great weekend.